Good morning. It is 10 a.m. We are here today, March 3rd, 2020, in the OPA hearing room, Suite 907 of the DNA building in Hagania, Guam, for the motion hearing of OPA PA 19-010 and 20-001, Glide Path Marianas Operations, Inc., versus the Guam Power Authority. Presiding over the hearing today is Public Auditor Benjamin J.F. Cruz. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Jared Hernandez and Vince Duenas. Will appellant Glide Path please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Public Auditor. My name is Joshua Walsh. I'm from Seville and Tank. We represent the appellant Glide Path in this matter. Also with me this morning are two institutional representatives, Mr. Peter Rude and Ms. Aaron Hazen, Glide Path Management.
Thank you. Will purchasing agency GPA please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Vincent Leon Guerrero on behalf of GPA. Sitting with next to me is the acting general manager, Melinda Mavlas.
Thank you. Will interested party NG Solar please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning. Marcel Johnson on behalf of NG.
And Anita Ariel on behalf of NG Solar.
We have no institutional representatives present.
Thank you. We may proceed.
Okay. I guess there's a whole series of motions that have been filed. I see there's no opposition to the, let's see the ones that are easy. There's no opposition to the interpreter.
There is, and I think the only request we have is that at some point when the interpreter gets designated, we can get the name and sort of the outfit that they're from and maybe a CV. But that's just so that we can see who the interpreter would be and
what interpreter would be, what language would we need an interpreter in?
It's Italian. We actually have two engineers who would need to come from Milan. However, given what's happening there right now, we'll probably have them appear via video conference.
Please. The room is too small.
But, and while it's not in opposition to the idea of an interpreter, it's just, you know, I think sort of like in a civil proceeding or a deposition, we just sort of like to know who the interpreter is, because if we're going to be all relying on one interpreter, I suppose that person would testify under oath or interpret under oath, and those sorts of procedures.
Between now and then, can you provide the CV and name of the interpreter?
Sure, once we have one, we'll.
Okay.
Thank you.
Will we need any other interpreters? Any other strange companies? We have no Korean companies.
No, just the Italian interpreter.
Just the Italian interpreter. Okay, so the interpreter issue is resolved. It's approved. You will provide the information to all the parties as to the CV and name. On the motion to allow for testimony via electronic means, is there an opposition to that one?
We have no opposition, and in fact, we're probably going to join in on that, given that we'll probably need to have those people from Milan testify via the conference as well. I'm sure we can work something out with Bypath in terms of how to set that up.
Is your are they all Italians on your side?
No, just two people. Oh, everybody else speaks English. And in fact, the two people that speak Italian also speak generally good English. It's just when asked questions, we want to make sure that their answers are as they understand the questions that are posed to them as clearly as possible.
Okay. All right, great. So there's no one has any opposition to the video testimony.
I would just ask if the parties are providing the equipment, if we can do a rehearsal setup.
I'll talk to Mr. Johnson and Mr. Ariel about how the nuts and bolts of that. I think we've all gone down that pathway before previously in front of the public auditor, so I'm not worried at all about us contacting Mr. Hernandez.
Okay, thank you.
Just full disclosure, we may end up not needing this on our side of things, but it was just in case.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad we can agree on two things. What was the third one? Supplemental?
So the first one is just the motion for discovery, then the screen.
We have the motion to exclude the comments on Covenant's competency. Whose motion was that?
That's Angie's motion.
Please.
This might well be taken in the same time as the other motion was made, but we essentially have the same arguments for both of them. The first is that under 2GAR 1249A(f), the public auditor is allowed to regulate the course of the hearing and conduct the participants therein, and to receive, rule on, exclude, or limit evidence, and limit lines of questioning and testimony which are irrelevant, material, or unduly repetitious. Really, the motion, the reason we filed these two motions in limine, one to exclude any reference to any violations of the automatic stay, and the other one to exclude any reference to any lack of confidence by a GPA to conduct this invitation for bids, really is just to so we can focus on the facts that really need to be set forth in this hearing. As we understand it, there's really only one issue, is whether Angie's bid was responsive, whether it complied with the technical specifications of the invitation for bid. There was no protest filed by GlidePath with respect to any alleged lifting of the automatic stay. There was no protest filed by GlidePath with respect to the specifications and whether they were confusing to the parties. The exact specifications that seems to concern them are those contained in Amendment 13 to the invitation for bids. Amendment 13 was issued on January 25th, 2019. Any protest that those specifications were confusing or that they would mislead the parties should have been filed within 14 days of GlidePath knowing, or they should have known that those specifications were confusing. That would have been 14 days after January 25th, 2019. That would have been February, over a year ago. So given that no protests were filed on these two points, and really that there's the only one issue in front of the OPA, whether NG's bid package met the specifications of the IFB, really whether it was responsive, we believe that we should stick to the facts that are pertinent and relevant to that one issue in front of the OPA, and really just and not present extraneous or irrelevant testimony that has nothing to do with that one issue that is before the OPA. That is why we filed these two motions.
Thank you very much.
So just briefly on that, the interested party is correct. We didn't protest of this procedure because of a violation of the automatic stay. But we did think it was relevant to comment, as the statute requires on the agency report, that we noticed that there was a violation of the automatic stay. I think the bulk of our opposition to the motions in limine is the idea that there's not a jury sitting over there. I think cases seem to be passing across the nation, that in cases where you have a jurist sitting and weighing evidence and ultimately going to make a decision in order based on the evidence presented, that the jurist is presumed not to be worried about a bell being rung that can't be unrung, or you know, needing to protect the jury from something. We've cited those cases from across the nation about how in a matter where you just have a jury, not a jury, but a jurist, a trial judge, that a need for a motion in limine is sort of, it doesn't make much sense because we're trying to exclude things by arguing to you that you should exclude it from your mind. We are quite confident in the ability of the hearing officer, the public auditor, to write an eventual decision in order that's just going to be based on whatever the public auditor thinks is relevant when that happens. So we think at a minimum it's premature, and if at all the public auditor is considering excluding evidence, that we sort of reserve on that until you actually see our presentation of our case. The idea that GlidePath was confused about what the IFB specification said and failed to protest that, that's not our protest. We were not confused. We understood what the IFB requirements said. The problem is once we protested that, GPA comes back and says, well, that's actually not what the technical specifications were. So it wasn't that we were confused at the time we filed our bid. Any sort of confusion over what the technical specs of the IFB are comes about because of GPA's response to our first protest. And in our second protest as well, asking GPA about the nature of these specifications. So we think it is relevant, just to address the merits of the motion limine, we do think it's relevant to show, to point out during the course of these proceedings, we've already pointed it out in our comments of the agency report, that GPA committed some other errors of the law along the lines here. You know, how is it that we could have an interested party that submits a bid, an appellant that submits a bid, And we think that the plain English language and the science and engineering definitions of these technical specs are clear. GPA runs away from that. And we, part of the reason for the motion is for discovery as well, is to try to see, well, how is GPA running away from what we think are pretty clear requirements?
And how much time do you think would be taken up in arguing these issues?
Not at all. I don't have a part of our presentation expected where we're going to be spending any testimony pointing out a lack of a violation of the automatic stay or pointing out any sort of other violations along the line. Our hearing presentation, our appeal, is based on what does this Amendment 13 that creates these requirements do to the IFB, and did ONGIE, who eventually won this, submit a bid that met the plain language of the requirements, or how did GPA come about to run away from what we think are pretty clear requirements of the IFB? That's the factual basis of the appeal. That's what our testimony is going to be on. Having to, you know, worry about polluting the mind of a jury because I accidentally mentioned as well in a findings of fact or a proposed hearing brief that, you know, that the automatic stay was also violated as well as one more error in this procurement, I think it's not needed. I think the public auditor is well positioned to deal with that when the public auditor writes his decision in this matter.
Do you have any position on this?
No, Your Honor.
Do you wish to respond?
Yes, there's a couple points I'd like to make. The cases cited by Glypath in its opposition brief generally refer to bench trials or non-jury trials. This is an administrative setting, so what the hearing officer with the public auditor is allowed to do here is controlled by the organic statute and the rules that set up the OPA. And as I mentioned earlier, 2 GAR 12109F specifically gives the hearing officer and public auditor the opportunity, if they wish, to exclude testimony which is not relevant or cumulative, or that really is, really what I'm going back to, is not relevant to the appeal that's before the OPA. And really that's what we're pressing on here, is that unless there was a protest filed showing the GPA, on the basis the GPA was incompetent to do this IFB, or to show that that GPA improperly lifted the automatic stay, then those issues aren't before the public auditor. And really, we have no reason to discuss this.
Just briefly on that, if I may. I think those objections could be made if on the trial day, when we have the hearing, I start wandering into an area that either GPA or ONGIE feels is irrelevant or we shouldn't waste any time on. An objection could be raised and said, Mr. Walsh, this area of exploration that you're doing is not needed for this, and we can make an immediate ruling there. But to try to sort of tell me now that I'm supposed to sanitize everything I'm supposed to do when it has been written yet or has been testified yet to protect a non-jury administrative hearing from hearing something about GPA's failures with the automatic stay or violating the law in that regard or any other sort of failing that may come up, I think it's just premature. So is it needed through a motion to eliminate now? I suggest it's not. I think if, like in any other administrative hearing, a piece of testimony is being explored or somebody proffers some evidence and some party wants to object to it, we could deal with the objection right there.
Why don't we do it this way? Why don't we grant the motion to eliminate? And if during the trial, I mean the administrative hearing, you feel that it is absolutely necessary to make, then we will readdress it at that point, but try to prepare it. I mean, with 12,000 pages,
yes.
Really seriously, we have lots to go on. And let's focus like laser on the one issue. And if it's 13, then it's 13, and we'll just leave it at that. Okay? Thank you. We took care of two motions there. There was a motion to compel the agency for an updated.
If I could address that, and I think it might make sense, unless anybody objects to it, to address that as well as my motion for discovery, because I think they're related.
Let's try, yeah, just one.
Just one, okay. So since the motion for discovery wasn't ruled on yet, we did file this motion to ask GPA to supplement the record. The reason we filed that motion was our review of the record shows no additional documents or no underlying technical justifications for this Amendment 13. and I wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything else out there that the agency could point to or had, but just didn't make as part of the record. So we filed a motion asking, could you please order GPA to supplement the record in that way. The other aspect that we thought was missing was we didn't see a record of communication, a log of communication. We see a bunch of emails, you know, but I don't see a log of phone calls from any outside parties to the government agency or anything like that. I think GPA's response to that motion was saying there is no log, I think confirming that. So I guess there's nothing to produce in that regard unless GPA wants to amend that sort of answer to that.
But there was a whole series of emails that are in there, and
there are
a whole series of communications, maybe not a log that says, that goes chronologically over the last 3 years.
Yep. Well, I will also say there are other things that I'm curious about. For instance, like, is any of this work done through WhatsApp at the agency, for instance? You know, I haven't seen sort of a printout of the WhatsApp communications between the procurement team, or do none exist? You know, if I put a Sunshine Act request out there, would we get those? So I've got the email communications, but I got no log of phone calls. But I've been told there's no log. I obviously am not going to ask for an order to compel them to recreate a log for the last several years, you know, because that can't be done. But I just wanted to know that, and I just wanted to know, is there anything else about this Amendment 13, document-wise, justification-wise, that the agency wants to put into this record before we actually move forward to the hearing? Because in a deposition, I could have just asked, but I thought best to meet our motion deadline by asking for clarification.
Was there anything that you need? I read the response. The response was just as it relates to the telephone calls. But is there anything else on 13 that needs to be?
There's nothing else, Your Honor. It's all on the record.
Does that include WhatsApps, can I ask?
It includes WhatsApp. There is no WhatsApp communication.
Okay.
If I may address the WhatsApp reference. Let's see.
The agency says they don't use WhatsApp.
Yeah, but also if it's the reference to WhatsApp between the agency itself, the rule specifically states a lot of communication between government employees and members of the public, or potential bidders or manufacturers. So anything communications within the agency wouldn't fall under what's required under the rule. So the other thing I'd like to mention too, though, is that given the fact that we have a record of all the emails that were sent back and forth between the agency, we have specification inside the invitation for bid that says that all communication between GPA and the outside world will be done via written communication, not oral communication. What we have here is about as complete a record as we possibly can of all the communications between the agency and the outside world. The statute itself doesn't define what a log is. It doesn't really go into any more detail than that. So sometimes in these cases we tend to wind up looking at legal dictionaries like Black's Law Dictionary. Black's Law Dictionary, if you look up what a log is, tells you to look up what a journal is, which says that a book or record kept usually daily on the proceedings of the legislature or the events of the ship's voyage. Also the term log or log books. And if you look into the definition of a log book, it specifically says a ship or aircraft's journal. It goes into more detail on that. The second definition is any journal or record of events. So we have here the procurement record that was released as a record of all the events of communication between GPA. We have all the emails. You know, if you write something down in a log, it would generally include, I assume, who sent the communication, when the communication was sent, who the communication was sent to. But here we have more than would be shown in that. We have the exact communication that was sent at that time. So we have more than would even be shown in a typical log book.
It was good to hear Angie's certification that the GPA record includes everything. I just wanted to make sure GPA confirm that, and we received GPA's confirmation that there's nothing else, so I'm satisfied on that.
Okay. May I have a motion for discovery?
It's my motion. I'll briefly address it. I know the public auditor has seen it. I fully recognize that asking for any form of sit-down deposition discovery in an administrative hearing in the world of the public procurement is not been done. I haven't found sort of a confirmation of allowing that to happen. I certainly acknowledge right out of the gate that there is not a rule of procedure that I can point to that says in the public auditor hearing, in the public auditor, a movement simply has to ask for something. You know, there's no equivalent rule of civil procedure. But what I can say is to cite the same body of law that everybody cites to in telling the public auditor, reminding the public auditor that they have the authority and the ability to run these proceedings as the public auditor sees fit. I also point out that, as we say in our brief, that the actual procurement code does make reference to the Administrative Adjudication of Act if there are silences, and the AAA, we think, allows for discovery to be taken. I could wait for a reply, but I'll go ahead and address what I know the main thrust of Angie's opposition to this is that, well, because of the way the statutes were sort of written, the statutory history, you know, what Josh Walsh is pointing to is justification under the Administrative Adjudication Act that would allow a deposition to be taken doesn't actually apply because there weren't sort of accepted rules in California for discovery proceedings when the original rule becomes part of the government code of law gets adopted. I think that seems to be Angie's argument there. And in response to that, I'd simply say that the case of Shibley versus Stewart that Angie relies upon to say, if you do the math, you know, 1945 from when the date of the government code is, you know, predates an allowance of discovery. I'd point out that in that case says that the legislature's silence with respect to pre-hearing discovery in administrative proceedings does not mean, however, that it has been rejected, or that concept has been rejected. Instead, as is in the case of criminal discovery, which in itself is a weird concept on this island, but they allow criminal discovery, it has been left to courts the question of whether modern concepts, and this is modern concepts from 1966, and we've moved on a fair number of years since then, whether modern concepts of administrative adjudication call for common law rules to permit and regulate the use of agency subpoena power to secure pre-hearing discovery. So I would humbly suggest that to the extent that Angie stands upon the Shibley versus Stewart case to say, California said there shall not be any pre-hearing discovery of an administrative proceeding pursuant to the AAA that forms the basis of our Administrative Adjudicative Act, I'd suggest the case doesn't say that. The case says in this particular situation, under this fact set of a doctor about ready to lose a license, will give you some pre-hearing discovery. But it does not, but the case clearly says the court is not saying you can never get it ever. I think the public auditor has the power to do this. I think the public auditor can do it if there's a justification. In this case, we've just heard that there's nothing further on this Amendment 13. There's no other justifications. Perhaps there were some oral communications, but they don't have to appear in the record. We think we could streamline the hearing with a deposition of a 30B6 type nominee for GPA. We'd notice it as such. We'd notice it as pursuant to the AAA, if that's the body of law that the public auditor says allows us to do it. You know, we follow the rules to do that, but we just don't know if we can do that yet. And I fully acknowledge that we're suggesting a novel concept here. And I'd add one other thing to my request, is just to point out that there is still, in my survey of the law, some confusion between how people practice between this level of review and the Superior Court. If we go to the Superior Court, are we bringing a civil action or is it a special proceeding? Right? I think. And if it's a civil action, do we therefore get discovery in the civil action in the Superior Court, or do we not? I can say, I haven't cited this in English, but I can say I've had Superior Court orders and appeals from the public auditor's office where I was told absolutely no discovery, right? Even though I captioned it as a civil action and tried to pursue, move forward under the civil rules. So I think what we have here then is a catch-22. If the Superior Court of Guam is dealing in a world where even if it's captioned as a civil action, you won't get discovery on that level. And here, as we build the administrative record, the justification is, well, we're supposed to move fast and quick, so therefore there should be no discovery at all. Then I suppose the idea then would have to be confirmed that no litigant gets any discovery in this procurement appeal process. And while I certainly understand the logic of not wanting an open door to all discovery anybody wants in any of these protests, you know, I'm protesting for 6 rolls of toilet paper or something like that, but in a case that involves whether or not the specs for a $200 million solar power procurement were spelled out correctly by GPA or were met by an interested party or were met by us even, I think in a case like that where we just heard that the record does not have any other documents about the technical justifications for this Amendment 13, which to my mind, in my read, just appear to appear, you know, they just have the new technical changes, I think, a limited discovery moment of a 30B6 style representative from GPA would be useful.
On Angie's, we have a, looking back to that Shively decision, the court did specifically say that the statute provides for depositions, but not for the purpose of discovery, to secure evidence for use in a hearing. As the opposing counsel mentioned, the statute was written by 1945, was adopted in the law in 1952. This is before the ability to do video conferencing, as we plan to do in this hearing today. So if anybody couldn't show up for live testimony in a hearing in front of an administrative agency, they simply wouldn't be heard. This rule, I believe, was meant to allow somebody who couldn't show up to that live hearing to still be able to provide testimony that was heard and taken into account. And again, in the Shively decision, the court made an exception in that case of those doctors, because what they had done technically was a crime in California at the time. So the court viewed it as a quasi-criminal proceeding where the state was bringing down its power on these people to remove their right to practice their profession and to make a living with that profession. So they believed it was important to make an exception in that case. Here we don't have a situation like that. We have two companies that are, or one company that is protesting an award of a government contract to another company. It's very different from having the state or the government bring charges against an individual and remove them, I guess, part of their liberty. Here we're really just discussing who's going to be awarded a government contract. It's not the type of situation where you need an exception to allow for this group. And the other point that I would like to make, though, is that the other section of that statute requires that a verified petition be made and that certain things be included in that verified petition. And it requires that the party mentioned the nature of the pending proceedings, provide the name and the address of the witness whose testimony is desired, a showing of the materiality of the witness's testimony, a showing that the witness will be unavailable or cannot be compelled to attend, and a request for an order requiring the witness to appear and testify before an officer named in the petition for that purpose. Several of those things aren't included in Glide Path's motion. They haven't named the witness or provided the address of the witness whose testimony is desired. They haven't shown the materiality of the witness that they want to depose. Showing the witness will be unable or cannot be compelled to attend. So even if an exception is made in this case, the minimum requirements in order to file a petition in order to permit a deposition under the statute have not been met by him. So
have all of you prepared your list of witnesses that you're planning on calling, and have any idea how long the presentation of your case will be?
I'll go ahead and tackle that. We're developing our list. Part of our development of that list is, you know, which one of our independent experts we're trying to retain, independent engineers to assist in this matter, are going to be physically present to do that. But I think the biggest question mark I have about our witness list is who from GPA I'm going to put on my witness list. Because I don't know if GPA is going to come in and simply say, well, you know, we hold these are the specs and this is what they say. And I'd like to be able to test, if need be, who the technical experts were at GPA that came up with this Amendment 13. So that's one part of my witness list that's vacant. I haven't quite solved who at GPA I need to put on my list in order to get into this.
Because just looking at the record, I mean, this is huge. Been trying to narrow it down and trying to figure out how many days or weeks we're going to be in hearing in this. Have you guys thought about how many people you're planning on?
We have, Your Honor, but we believe that the issue here is fairly narrow, and we don't anticipate we're going to take days and days or weeks and weeks. Now, that might be Glide Path's, you know, strategy, but we don't believe that that's going to be our strategy, and we think that the issues are fairly easy to resolve. We don't expect that we're going to, I mean, at this point, I can't even think that we have, you know, 10 witnesses.
No, I mean, it's not so much that with the issue that he has, or that GlidePath has, and with all the practice that has gone on since 1945, and probably more than anybody in here knows more about litigation. And wouldn't discovery assist in narrowing the issue if we could get one or two people from GPA to answer the the question that Glidepath has, and you'd be able to address that, or would we need to have him bring in 8-10 people from GPA, and you're not going to be ready to address the issues that they're coming up with? But if between now and the hearing date, he has the opportunity to name the person. You mentioned that he doesn't name the name of the person, but if there's one or two, and it can be narrowed to that, wouldn't that assist in moving this further and not surprising you at hearing when he comes up with that?
I mean, just in terms of having GPA mentioned, would they plan, just have everybody provide their witness lists next week or so?
But
actually, yeah, depositions.
Well, no, I mean, I'm suggesting that everybody from GPA be deposed, but he has one, at least my understanding, it's just one issue on the technical note and how that arrived at then.
May I just add that can be done very easily with a subpoena. If you want someone to testify about Amendment 13, he subpoenas a GPA witness who's going to be testifying about, you know, whatever Amendment 13 specifications he wants. And we don't need discovery on that. And then that way we know who that person's going to be. GPA will designate that person, and that person's going to be brought in here. I mean, it's different from a Rule 30b-6 deposition, but it's pretty much the same thing that he's looking for, which is, you know, he doesn't know who that person is. He doesn't know who the engineer is or engineers. He just issues a subpoena, you know, to have GPA name who that person is and that person is brought in. There aren't that many people at GPA who are going to be testifying with respect to the specifications in this case.
Well, I would have, you know, part of the failing that the interested party finds with our request for the discoveries, we don't name who we want. We don't run through the AAA, you know, to check the boxes on there. I don't know what the public auditor's order is going to be about whether or not that law applies. But on the idea of not knowing the name of the witness, I agree with Masario on this. I don't know. If I was allowed to take a short deposition, I would simply send a 30B6 notice to GPA, say, "Dear GPA, these are the categories of testimony I'd like. I want to get to the heart of these issues before I have to spend time at an administrative hearing in front of the public auditor to do it. So I'd like a day to ask questions about this to get my case ready and understand what GPA really felt about this Amendment 13. So yes, the 30B6, that was the goal of a 30B6 style deposition. And I also just think for the broader idea, this may be a good case for me to humbly suggest that the public auditor can cross this bridge on whether or not we're going to allow discovery in these cases at all, because especially if the Superior Court is not allowing discovery in civil actions captioned as such in appeals from this case, whenever is this going to be allowed? Or is perhaps the rule going to be it's never allowed? And I just add one other thing. GPA would be the target of this discovery. So the arguments being raised by the interested party saying why or why not GPA should not be allowed to testify, I think that really should be GPA's arguments. I'm not making a standing objection about the wrong party filing a motion to quash, but you know, I do understand that GPA eventually came in and said they don't want this deposition, but you know, GPA's positions on this, I think, are more important.
Well, I would disagree with that, Mr. Auditor, because we are an interested party in this case. We're the winning bidder. And so we're required now to come in here because Glidepath has filed a protest. And we don't want to be here, but we're here reluctantly because our protest has been filed. It's the same as in any other trial or proceeding. If they want to have somebody get up there and testify, they can just ask GPA to designate that person and subpoena the person who's responsible for the Amendment 13 technical specifications, and we go from there. To allow discovery, I think, is to open the floodgates of discovery in other procurement actions, and the whole purpose behind an OPA appeal is that we're supposed to try to get this done quickly, expeditiously, efficiently, and as speedily as possible, because this is a procurement issue.
We have
a project that's not going forward because of this protest.
But it would seem to me that at least from some of the appeals that have gone to court and some that are in their seventh year, I'm wondering whether or not the Superior Court ruled against discovery might have assisted in shortening those hearings and making a record that could be addressed by the court above. But to continue to say no discovery and yet appeals are taking years, and I'm concerned that it's affecting you as the winning bidder, that you never get to move forward. If you know there's a stay, or you just can't start, or if the protesting party is losing money every year that they had not had it, it just seemed to me, as the as Mr. Walsh put it, when will you ever do that if it doesn't start? And I'm just wondering if we could just narrow this to 13 and the issue that he has with it, with a deposition, and not have to have all the other.
I think Shibley versus Stewart, while it says everything that Angie says, and I really understand the 1945 timeline, the jurist in the California Appeal Court recognized, I think, this kind of moment where, while their legislature was silent on whether pre-hearing discovery and administrative proceedings was going to be allowed, the jurist in this case specifically say that doesn't mean that it's been rejected. It means that it is for the future jurists, future folks who are crossing these issues, to figure out whether the modern concepts of discovery that arise, this is being written in 1966, we're sitting here in 2020, would justify this world. And I am certainly not in favor of a blanket sort of idea that every procurement act, you know, protest results in discovery. I think if the legislature wants to do that, they can clearly say that. But I think the legislature, by giving the public auditor the authority to control evidence, control how these hearings go, the Guam legislature, by pointing to the Administrative Adjudication Act at a date after 1945, I think I do have that math right, when the government code gets adopted into our new green books and we keep readopting them, bringing them back, I think it allows the public auditor to issue a decision on this other than just saying, Mr. Walsh, you haven't pointed to a specific rule, so the answer is no. And if it means that we get a common law procedural future here where if somebody thinks it's really important to ask for discovery and you got to justify it, at least we'll know how to do that. We'll know what the steps are. There'll be an order saying, you know, if you really need this, submit your motion by such a date and articulate A, B, and C. But right now we have none of that. And
if you were able to articulate A, B, and C as to who it was that you needed or wanted from GPA, is there...
I'd defer to them. I'd ask GPA to designate somebody to answer questions on several categories related to the formation of the nub of this issue, the technical requirements, these ideas that there's a certain amount of megawatt output that comes out from the power system in the GPA, 30 megawatts, to offer testimony about how that line was came up, how that was supposed to interact with this other idea about the maximum size of the electronic storage system, the battery part of this process, and then what we think is this 145% requirement ratio, and who came up with that, and how is that supposed to interact with the total size of the build-out, the amount of panels that are going to be on this location. We think there's a three-legged stool of math here that when you apply it, comes up with a plain reading that we thought was pretty clear when we put our bid in. I'm speaking on behalf of GlidePath here. But GPA seems to disagree with that, and Angie disagrees with that as well in their papers. So I would like to talk to somebody at GPA about that Amendment 13, especially because the 1,200 pages of the 13-volume record, while having some email back and forth about including parts of Amendment 13, and there are some parts in that record that seem to say, like, you know, we're checking the boxes on answering questions, I don't see any technical jargon, justification to feed to anybody on how this three-legged stool of math got set up. And I'm just a lowly lawyer, so the more information I can have from engineers about the three-legged math, I think the easier it comes on March 25th to actually go through the testimony, because the way it looks right now is I'm not going to know who to designate, and I have to put a witness in, so I'm going to do my best from the procurement record to just put every GPA name there until I find out these people can't answer the questions. Or perhaps Ms. Ariola suggested where, if we're all in agreement, I could put on my witness list the GPA person who can answer these questions and just leave it as a blank like that and have GPA put somebody up. Or perhaps I do a 30B6 deposition, get it out of the way between now and March 25th, and narrow down my list and proceed that way. That's my suggestion.
Does GPA have any comments?
I apologize, Your Honor. I just got on this case recently, and I just note that GPA filed its opposition to the motion for discovery on the 24th. We submit on that. The other concern I would have is that if they were to do a deposition, would this delay the, you know, the schedule on this case? I'm not sure if that's going to be the case at this point, but that would be one of the concerns we would have.
I think with GPA now having two counsel, Anji having two firms, and our office having multiple attorneys, I'm quite sure we'll be able to find a deposition date that works for at least one of three of our attorneys between now and the 25th of March without having any slippage in the date, because I know Anji really wanted to keep that date, and the public auditor set that date. So we're prepared to move forward and do the deposition at some point between now and then.
There's one point that I'm...
I'd like one of you, all of you, to comment on another part. I'm a little concerned about the fact that, as you put it, the Superior Court has been adamant about the fact that it is not allowing depositions and special proceedings, regardless of how they're denoted. They're marked as civil, not SP. How do you believe that it'll be received, and how should we send that issue to them?
Well, I can imagine if the public auditor denies my motion. And I thought, after the conclusion of the proceedings on this level, and if we thought there was some merits to moving forward to the Superior Court level, I suppose that issue could get raised again. But I suppose by that time, it kind of almost be like a moot issue, because we would have spent the days of testimony without the discovery. I think in the inverse, if you allowed me to take the deposition, unless somebody runs the court and try to get an injunction against that, maybe it gets tested that way, but I don't know. I just, the door is open, and I think that you're allowed, you can do these things, and if somebody wants to pick a fight about it, the litigants can pick a fight about that at the next level.
Here's my concern in terms of, it addresses this issue as well. Here we have a closed procurement record, which is defined by law, and all the parties that when they bid, they were aware of. If we start allowing discovery at this level, to why the technical requirements were set up in the way that they were. We're introducing evidence in front of the hearing for the OPA to make a decision based on information that was not available to the parties at the time that they submitted their bids. So we're going back and changing the facts and look at things in hindsight in order to figure out what the parties should have or should not have known at the time. Here, as we mentioned earlier, the one real issue in front of the OPA here is whether or not NG's bid was responsive. If it was responsive, meaning that it met the technical requirements of the invitation for bids, at the time that all bidders submitted their bids, the question is closed. The question of how GPA came up with the technical requirements, whether they were in the original IFB or whether they were in the amendments, really isn't before us. If there was an issue with those, or if Anji found a problem, if GlidePath found a problem with them, they should have submitted a protest after Amendment 13 was put out. The question here really is whether or not Angie, in submitting its bid on the date that the bids were due, complied with the technical requirements. Looking into how those technical requirements were put together, or what GPA's intent was at the time, doesn't help us determine whether or not Angie met those technical requirements on the date that the bids were due, which is really the only question.
Can I just one point to that? This isn't as simple as GPA was requesting the widgets shall be blue, and did Angie submit blue widgets, right? Here, the technical requirement is not as simple as are the widgets blue. The technical requirement says the widget must be 145% of the ESS system storage, right? So it's not just blue or red. We need to know, well, what did they mean by 145% of the system storage? Because we thought it was pretty clear when we submitted our bid. How is it any different now? How did this math add differently? So I agree that did ONGE meet a technical requirement? GPA says the technical requirement means a certain thing now. We did not see that as the plain language reading of what the technical requirement was. But it's not as simple as me just trying to argue red and blue. You know, there were three parts of a math equation here that needed to be met. That's why I think in this limited circumstance, a short period of discovery.
But as was pointed out by ONGE, when the 145 came up in 13, shouldn't you have raised the question or asked the question in January of 19? How is this going to be computed so that your bid would be able to meet the...
Right, we were not confused. We asked the questions, we got answers from GPA that you know, our presentation is going to be about why there was no confusion about that. The only confusion about the first time that the first time that GlidePath understands from GPA's perspective that these requirements mean something different in the mind's eye of GPA is after we protest the win by ONGE. ONGE wins. ONGE puts out a press release saying that our system has these components. We say, well, wait a second, those components are not compliant with the IFP, so we protest. And then GPA says, oh, no, that's A, B, and C are fine under this. And that's why we're protesting. It wasn't that we were confused at the time we submitted our bid, because I agree, if we were confused at the time we were submitted our bid, like the other folks who submitted bids along the same lines we did, I think everybody had this view of what it meant. The first time that we hear from GPA that that's not what it meant is when GPA responds to our protest blessing ONGE's proposal, which does the math a little bit different. And that's the heart of the issue. And I will point out that GPA never thought we were untimely. They didn't deny us on that ground. You know, we are appealing GPA's determination that the IFB specs say this, because we don't think they say that.
Do you have a comment?
I would just be rehashing what I said earlier. So
no, I appreciate your comment earlier about the fact that we may be widening it. Mm-hmm. And Phil Misariello knows me from having suffered me before, that I'm willing to blow up things. Just to see how endless Leon Guerrero suffered me. I think maybe just the fact that this is on the record, that this discussion was had, and that you have it as a point that you can raise on appeal. If the Superior Court has been saying no to discovery, I don't think I want to do that right now on this one. Now that you have this as an issue on appeal.
And actually, in all candor to the public auditor, I want to point this out. The last time I raised this issue before Judge Lamarina, Mr. Perez, who is arguing on behalf of the public auditor, did take the position for this office that discovery wasn't allowable in that situation as well. So I have a duty to make sure I let you know that if you know, so it's happened. I mean, you know, if your concern is what...
No, I understand what but it would seem to me that we try to narrow and to expedite these things, and if we could somehow do it, I was hoping that with all of your experience with depositions, that it would seem to me that it would be a way to be able to narrow it, but as the Superior Court has been saying no to it, and I don't want that to be the immediate reason for which our decision is reversed, but I will allow it. I mean, I will have at least this discussion on the record that I would hope that the Superior Court and the Supreme Court, the Superior Court reconsider that position.
Thank you.
So that we no longer have appeals that go on for years. And,
we appreciate that.
The motion be denied.
Thank you.
With this on the record. All right. Do I leave any other motion out?
Anything else? No, I think it's.
Okay. And so get your CV to them. Get this set up for the video and everything else.
And I, and just on a note of optimism, I do intend on circulating a stipulation about as many sort of uncontroverted facts, I hope, as we can agree to. Just let Mr. LG, Mr. Serio, and Mr. Johnson. And likewise, we'll accept any offered stipulations anybody wants if it helps the gentleman.
Great.
Thank you.
Please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr.
I remember your, on the 13th, your list of materials.
Yes.
And witness list is due.
Oh. On, may I ask one question about that? The use of, like, PowerPoints or demonstrative exhibits on the, for the day of the hearing, how do we want to handle that in a particular way? Sort of,
present them on the 13th?
Yeah, well, I guess not necessarily evidence to be submitted at the, at, you know, on the record, but just if I wanted to use a PowerPoint at the hearing, how do you guys want to do that? Sort of?
I think we'd like to see them before we use them. I don't know if that's covered within the exhibits, if it's demonstrative items, but we would just see them.
Let me like that too. What do you?
If you need support.
The questions on just the demonstrative exhibits, PowerPoint presentations, or anything like that.
So
you know, models.
To exchange them?
Yeah, if you would exchange it with each other, because
right.
I know nothing about electricity in this.
What,
so anything
like
that you can do to assist me in, I mean, I'll admit that straight up. And I'm amazed at how much you guys seem to understand it.
We're just going to Instagram the whole thing.
So, if anything that'll help me visualize what happened and what the issue is, I will allow. Okay, but make sure that it's all you've all shared it, and you're not
absolutely
bringing some interesting thing into. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're off the record at 10:53 a.m.